This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
It's the first trading day of the new year. Markets had some pretty good numbers, and some presidential candidates did too. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From Washington, D.C., I'm Kimberly Adams in for Kai Rizdal. It's Thursday, January 2nd. Good to have you with us. We'll start off today with some currency news. The U.S. dollar is a big deal throughout the global market, and over the last year, it increased in value relative to other currencies. That is until September, when the dollar started a slide that now has it down 2.5% from where it started. Most of that drop happened in December, when the dollar had its biggest monthly decline in almost 2 years. We asked Marketplace's Nova Safo to take a look at what happened and what that means for you and me.
One of the reasons the dollar went up about 3% earlier this year is global economic uncertainty.
Historically, people have turned to the dollar when they see turmoil elsewhere. It's thought to be a safe haven.
That's Dean Baker of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. But as Europe tackled its debt crisis and the global economy picked up a bit, fears of a deep global economic slowdown faded, and that trend has continued.
Expectations for the state of economies outside the U.S. have actually perked up a little bit.
Ian Shepherdson with Pantheon Macroeconomics says that optimism means less need for a safe haven, so the dollar's value has been dropping. Also, he says, the Federal Reserve has been pumping more money into the U.S. financial system.
And that means there's more dollars around, and like everything else, when there's more of something around, the price tends to fall.
So is the falling dollar a good thing or bad? Well,
it would make imports from abroad more expensive.
That's the bad side, says Kathy Bush-Chancic of Oxford Economics. Clothing could cost more, hurting retailers. Cars could get pricier, too. On the other hand, stuff U.S. companies sell overseas could become cheaper, benefiting multinationals. That's why President Trump has signaled the desire for a weaker dollar to reduce the trade deficit. But in order for the dollar's worth to really make an impact, Bush-Chancic says it would have to fall much further.
10% or more, and it would be sustained over a period of time.
So the question now, she says, is what happens in the next few months. I'm Nova Safo for Marketplace.
Speaking of dollars, presidential candidates have been crowing about how many they're bringing in. White House hopefuls are starting to report how much they raised in contributions during the last quarter of 2019, with early numbers coming in from President Trump, Joe Biden, and Bernie Sanders, among others. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Ginzer reports that some candidates are seeing a surge in donations.
President Trump's campaign says it raised $46 million during the last 3 months of 2019, its best fundraising quarter of the 2020 campaign. Can you say impeachment?
Impeachment is playing into Trump's narrative that he is being persecuted by Democrats.
That's Lee Drutman, a senior fellow at New America. He says Trump supporters responded to impeachment with an avalanche of donations. On the Democratic side, Bernie Sanders reported raising more than $34 million. Columbia University law professor Richard Berfalt says Trump and Sanders both took a page out of the public radio playbook.
Getting people to commit to giving a certain small sum, but to give it over and over again, maybe on a monthly basis.
Democrats Joe Biden and Pete Buttigieg, who don't rely as much on small donors, still reported raising more than $20 million last quarter. But it's hard to overcome the advantage of incumbency. Unlike other presidents who took a break from campaigning, President Trump filed for re-election shortly after taking office. Chara Torres-Spellacy is a law professor at Stetson University.
So the fact that he has had fundraising going on in the background for the past 3 years, I think, can only work to his advantage.
The presidential campaigns don't have to officially report their fourth quarter fundraising totals until the end of this month. So far, We're just hearing from candidates who have something to brag about. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, markets had a strong start to the new year. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Earlier this week, the IRS announced some changes that might make it less expensive for you to file your taxes this year. The updates come following a series of stories from ProPublica in the last year, saying that the tax filing software TurboTax, made by the company Intuit, may have been pushing customers to pay for tax prep that should have been free. Investigative reporter Justin Elliott has been on this story for ProPublica. Justin, welcome to the program.
Hey, good to be here.
This all has to do with the IRS Free File program. Can you explain how that program is supposed to work?
Sure. So the program is a deal between the government and the tax prep industry. And what it says is that the industry, including TurboTax, has to offer free versions of their products to most Americans. And in exchange, the IRS agrees not to make its own online filing product that would compete with the industry.
And how has that worked so far?
Well, it's worked well for the industry, which has had record profits. But even though at least 100 million households are eligible to use these free products, very few, like under 5%, actually have historically, and instead end up paying Intuit, the company that makes TurboTax, or H&R Block, or another one of these companies. And part of the reason for that was that the industry, including TurboTax, were taking steps to essentially hide these truly free versions. One of the things that we reported on was that Intuit and H&R Block had actually added programming code to their free websites so you couldn't find it through a Google search.
So what changes with this week's announcement from the IRS?
So a couple things change. First of all, the IRS has now said the companies are not allowed to hide the real free file versions from search engines. So in the case of TurboTax, which is the biggest player in this market, there's a TurboTax free file version, and that's the version offered through this IRS deal. And then there's something called TurboTax Free, which is actually different, even though it has a similar name. And if you click on that one, you may well end up paying. So there's essentially kind of a secret door, which again is the IRS free file version, which is what you want to find, which now should be easier to find through search. So that's one of the big changes.
What else changes?
So the other big change is that for almost 20 years, the IRS, as part of this deal, had promised not to create a free online filing product of its own. And this is actually something that exists in many other developed countries. You just go to the tax agency to do your taxes. You don't have to go through a private company that you have to pay. So now with this new deal, that language has been dropped. So the IRS no longer has this prohibition on creating its own, essentially its own version of TurboTax. Some people in Congress have been calling on them to do that for a while. So I think if they choose to do that, it would be a while away. But now this barrier has been taken away.
Right now, it isn't easy for many people to fill out their taxes with what the IRS has available, these online forms and things. And Intuit says that, you know, they are making taxes simple for many, many people. They have a statement on their site strongly disputing the accusations in a lot of your reporting, and then also saying that they strongly support these IRS changes. What's your take on the company's response?
Yeah, so I think that tax filers out there, we're all going to be doing our taxes soon, should basically take the company at its word and find the truly free version. I should also say that we've reported that several state attorneys general are investigating Intuit over some of the things that we've reported, and they've also been sued. There's several lawsuits ongoing. So some of this is still playing out. As you've said, the company has denied any kind of wrongdoing.
Justin Elliott is an investigative reporter at ProPublica and the lead reporter on the series, The TurboTax Trap. Justin, thanks.
Thanks so much.
You can find links to ProPublica's reporting on this, as well as a link to Intuit's response on marketplace.org. More than 2 million migrants have traveled to the European Union in the past 5 years, most crossing the Mediterranean on often harrowing, sometimes deadly, journeys. European countries are struggling to integrate the new arrivals. Denmark has taken in a large number of people seeking asylum relative to its small population, including around 20,000 Syrians. Many have been given the right to stay, but now the Danish government is paying some of them to return to Syria, despite the ongoing conflict there. At least 71 people have taken up the offer since the summer. The BBC's Damian Grammaticus reports from the capital, Copenhagen.
Hi, Manal. It's Damian calling from Copenhagen. How are you? How is Damascus?
I'm very good. Thank you very much.
Manal Tahan is one of the Syrians who's taken up the offer. There's fewer than 100 of them, but she's now back in Damascus.
It's good things because when we came back, we will start from zero, from nothing. For me, I lost my houses in the war. I lost everything. This money very good, like to start my life.
Manal says she found fitting into life in Denmark difficult. There was problems for her children with schooling, and she believes she's much happier back in Syria. It's 8 o'clock in the morning and already busy at work at his sewing machine is Ahmed Bakir from Syria. Ahmed has been in Denmark for nearly 10 years. He says it was tough at first, but he's now set himself up in business. And the money that's on offer for people to return to Syria, he says, really isn't very much.
I am welcome here. I am welcome. I don't feel I am not welcome. I am welcome here. But for me, I will not say yes for this money because I can work for 3 months I make this money, 3-4 months.
So to the money they're offering isn't enough, really, for you to go home?
If it's 50,000 kron, I can make it for 3 months.
Inside Denmark's parliament, it's busy. People coming and going. The traditional political parties here have been under pressure because of a growing right-wing and anti-immigrant feeling. And in the last election, the centre-left noticeably toughened their stance towards immigrants. They now form the government. Rasmus Stockland is the immigration and integration spokesman.
When you have a model like ours, where education is free and where benefits are generous and where taxes are high and where there's a lot of welfare that is universal to anyone, then you have to be relatively strict on who can come into the country.
Those who do take up the offer and go to Syria can, Denmark says, change their minds. But there are caveats. They have to do it in the first year. They'd have to repay all the money Denmark had given them, so they'd incur a big debt. And would people want to come back to a country where they hadn't felt welcome in the first place?
The BBC's Damian Grammaticus in Copenhagen. Coming up,
what I felt were quite impressive skills didn't translate well.
When looking for a new job doesn't quite go as planned. But first, let's do the numbers. On the first trading day of 2020, the Dow Jones Industrial Average boosted 330 points, 1.1%, to close at 28,868. The Nasdaq advanced 119 points, 1.3%, to finish at 9092. And the S&P 500 rose 27 points, 0.8%, to end at 3257. The Trump administration today banned some popular vaping flavors like fruit and mint. The FDA says the move is to curb the teen use of e-cigarettes. So tobacco giant Altria Group, which has a large stake in e-cigarette maker Juul, smoldered down 1.3%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.87%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Hello to 2020 and all the new Marketplace investors who joined us before the end of the decade. Thank you so much for being part of this community of donors who believe in the importance of trustworthy, independent news and information. It's your ongoing support that keeps us going strong and helps make people smarter everywhere. Thanks again, and Happy New Year.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kimberly Adams. If the health effects aren't enough to scare you off smoking, it can also hurt your job prospects. U-Haul announced that starting February 1st, smokers need not apply for jobs with the moving and storage company in 21 states. Other states have laws barring hiring discrimination against smokers of tobacco products, and increasingly, marijuana products. There's a new law that just took effect in Nevada banning employers from denying jobs to applicants who test positive for the drug. From the Workplace Culture Desk, Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has more.
In California, where recreational marijuana has been available for several years and medical has been available for two decades, buying it is as easy as dropping by the store and showing ID.
It makes it feel like I'm not doing anything wrong.
20-year-old Layla Larson says she's a daily user to help manage her epilepsy and anxiety, but it's made it hard to find a job in her town outside San Diego.
I'll go on Craigslist and look for job offerings. I'll look on the mall website, and it all says requires a drug test.
California, like most states where cannabis is legal, doesn't have any laws protecting users from pre-employment drug tests.
Clearly, drug testing policies are lagging behind.
Ethan Nadelman is the founder of the Drug Policy Alliance, which advocates for liberalizing drug laws. He says without protections for job seekers, cannabis users can still feel criminalized. He points out people can drink alcohol recreationally without it affecting their job prospects.
Whereas the use of marijuana is something that was very much more demonized.
He notes there's a class element, too, as many minimum wage jobs in retail and food service still test for cannabis. Attorney James Reedy specializes in employer law in New Hampshire and says he has seen a drop in the number of companies testing for marijuana, but some CEOs still insist on it.
What that gets to is the notions of, could this affect someone's attendance? Is this going to affect their motor skills? But it could also be, in part, a moral judgment.
A report from drug testing company Quest Diagnostics shows that the number of pre-employment cannabis tests it administered didn't change much between 2015 and 2018. It did drop about 4% in states that allow recreational use. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
In the last couple of years, thousands of teachers have walked out of classrooms, demanding changes in their school districts. From West Virginia to California, most of the districts did increase teacher pay and promised smaller class sizes and more support in the schools. But many teachers are still waiting to see if everything they fought for on the picket lines actually happens in practice. In a new article from California Sunday Magazine, writers Alexandria Neeson and Emmanuel Felton interviewed 10 teachers about their experiences striking and demonstrating, reflecting on what those educators gained and what still troubles them today. Welcome to you both.
Hi, thank you for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
I'd like to start with you, Alex. What happened in the last year or two to make all these teachers start striking now?
Teacher strikes are definitely not new, but I think in the last couple of years, we've seen a huge increase in them. There was sort of this wave that began in West Virginia and spread across the country. But really, I think the seeds for that started in places like Chicago, where teachers were attracting national media attention for their efforts. And I think that from there, teachers elsewhere kind of started to pay attention. And then in West Virginia, we saw this unprecedented wave of action from teachers. And I think from there, other teachers elsewhere said, hey, we can do this too.
Right. It sounds like there were some common themes there, Emmanuel.
Yeah, I think what we're seeing around the country is like school districts are still reeling from the historic budget cuts we saw after the Great Recession, right? So teachers are dealing with it on both ends, right? So we have stagnant teacher salaries in many of these places, coupled with, especially in places like Oakland and Los Angeles and Denver, skyrocketing housing prices. And I think, you know, a lot of the strike was about conditions for students, but also teachers around the country are in a real pinch right now.
Staying with you, Emmanuel, from the 10 teachers you profiled, did you feel that most of them were satisfied with what they got in the end?
No, and I think that really surprised me, actually, because like I said, the media narrative after the strike was teachers made this huge victory. And I think like that is very true. But at the same time, I mean, you know, there's one teacher I talked to in Oakland who said, you know, going into the strike, she didn't even see as possible a salary that would make living in Oakland viable long term, just because of how expensive Oakland has become. And so she was more focused on, you know, getting more school social workers, getting more librarians, getting more nurses in the classroom. And I think on those issues, teachers did see pretty big gains in many places.
During the walkouts, these teachers weren't getting a paycheck, and several of the folks you interviewed shared how they handled that. Alex, whose stories really jumped out at you?
There's one teacher in Denver, Christina Medina, and part of her preparation for the walkout there involved making some of her favorite dishes. She made burritos, for example, and froze all of them. She kept them in glass containers in her freezer. And this is basically how she saved money to make sure that she could do things like pay her mortgage every week. She'd kind of take a look at her finances and decide if she could afford things like fresh fruit or vegetables. After the strike, in fact, when she was able to finally calculate the dollar amount that she'd lost to participate in the strike, she decided, well, it looks like I'm not going to be able to afford those things until I can recover and make sure that my bills are paid.
So there's always going to be risks when people go out on strike or walk out, financial or otherwise. But, you know, as you mentioned earlier, in many places in the country, school funding hasn't really recovered since the recession, while the rest of the economy has bounced back. And several of the teachers that you highlight in the piece talk in pretty vivid detail about what that actually looks like in classrooms. What were they telling you?
In Arizona, I think this problem is particularly potent. And this is a concern that teachers have had there for much longer than just the most recent walkout that we saw there across the state. And so Chico Robinson, a teacher there in Phoenix that I interviewed, talked about that. And so teachers working in school districts across that state do things like door knocking over summers because they have to rely on getting voters to pass bonds so that they can do things like repair buildings, install air conditioning, and all, you know, other maintenance costs that the state is not covering. And he talked about how disappointing that is, that moving into the next year, even after such a successful and inspiring wave of teacher activism, that still remains true.
Alex Neeson and Emmanuel Felton, their piece on teacher walkouts is in the California Sunday magazine. Thank you both for being here.
Thanks so much.
Thanks.
All week in our series, My Economy, we've been exploring the lives and jobs of the fastest growing segment of the labor force, workers over the age of 55. Today's story takes us around the world and lands in Denver, Colorado.
My name is Mary Dean Purvis, and I do short-term international consulting after having been abroad for many years. Many people, when I try and explain to them what it is I do, they ask me immediately, are you a missionary? And if I say no, they say, well, then are you a diplomat? And I say, no, there's actually a whole profession that's in between those two. I decided at the end of 2012 to move back to the United States, partly for family reasons, and also I felt that I needed to connect with my own country. And I was confronted with the reality that what I felt were quite impressive skills didn't translate well. I started taking short-term assignments back in the same countries that I had been living in until I settle on something full-time here. While I'm in the U.S., I make presentations in senior living centers. One of them that is most popular, it's called Designing Africa. And in that, I present all of the design aspects that I lived with and learned from about Africa. So I have fabrics, textiles, I have sculptures, beaded jewelry. And we talk also about the contributions that the African continent has made to the world in general. So I get as much out of that, interacting with them, talking with them, listening to their stories. It's just a really mutually beneficial interaction. I never thought I'd still be getting on planes, flying into developing countries, and getting involved in conflict recovery and development issues at this age. I honestly thought that I would be able to settle down and get involved in my local civic community. Not that I'm not doing that, but you know, you have to put the rest of the life back here on hold a bit.
Mary Dean Purves in Denver, Colorado. After traveling the world, the stories she could tell. Tell us yours at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out, lots of folks are attempting a dry January to recover from holiday excess. According to Nielsen, over a fifth of Americans took the month off from alcohol last year, and 83% of those said they'd do it again this year. You'd think that would be a bad thing for the beer industry, but instead, they're using the time to market their non-alcoholic beers. Heineken offered a free 31-can January dry pack to those who planned ahead, kind of like an advent calendar of alcohol-free booze. Those packs are all claimed now, but there are still plenty of non-alcoholic six-packs from several brands still available. Or you could just drink water. We've got to go. Today, the Dow was up 330 points, 1.1%. The NASDAQ was up 119 points, 1.3%. And the S&P 500 rose 27 points, 0.8% there. Amir Babawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, and John Gordon are the Marketplace editing staff. Betsy Streisand is the managing editor. And I'm Kimberly Adams. We'll be back tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.